From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Why don't facts matter? Hello again, I'm Marvin Olney, and this is To the Point. In this divided nation, more and more people respond only to new information that reinforces their established opinions. When they're presented with facts that contradict what they believe, their opinions get stronger, even when the contradictory evidence is irrefutable. Has the country become the emotional states of America, or is there something about the way the human brain is wired? We'll talk to a neuroscientist, a foreign policy expert, and an obstetrician who performs abortions in Alabama in the name of science and Christianity. On today's Talking Point later, nobody knew tax reform could be so complicated. First, here's the news.
Check out KCRW's all-news channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, the BBC, and more 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24, or you can listen on KCRW's app.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Olney, back with To the Point. Fake news may have a long history, but social media and 21st century politics have brought it front and center. One reason for its appeal and its power is the tendency of so many people to cling to their beliefs, even when confronted with contradictory factual evidence. Today, another look at the emotional states of America. Later on today's Talking Point, President Trump says the failed attempt to replace Obamacare taught him how complicated health care can be. Next up, tax reform. First, this news update. British Prime Minister Theresa May threw down a gauntlet today, calling an early election for June 8th in an effort to gain strength for negotiations on Brexit. That, of course, is Britain leaving the European Union. Outside No. 10 Downing Street, May challenged her political opposition.
You have criticized the government's vision for Brexit. You have challenged our objectives. You have threatened to block the legislation we put before Parliament. This is your moment to show you mean it, to show you are not opposing the government for the sake of it, to show that you do not treat politics as a game.
Alan Cowell contributes to the New York Times from London. Good to have you with us. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, it's good to be with you again, Warren.
Why is it that Theresa May needs to have an early election?
I think it's a question of her legitimacy in the sense of whether she has a mandate. Let's not forget that during the campaign before last year's referendum, she was formally, at least, although rather lukewarm, in the campaign to remain in the European Union. And now she's emerged as the prime minister of a country that is set and bent on leaving the European Union. So that is a question that she has to resolve for a variety of reasons, both the politics of her own party and the visage she is able to present to the other Europeans.
What is the legislation she refers to that she says the opposition wants to block?
Well, that would be various legislations. There's a grand repeal act that is with one fell swoop, remove all the European laws in the statute books, or rather remove them from the European domain and put them in the British statute books, so that they could be cherry picked from there for those items of legislation from Europe that the British wanted to either retain or reject.
So there's a lot of pushback then to what she is trying to do. But mainly what she needs, as you indicated at first, is legitimacy. She needs strength.
That's very much the point. And I think what's one seen today in the statements by her close allies is an attempt to cast this forthcoming election as a test of loyalty among the British people. She's suggested that, you know, if people still cling to the idea of remaining in the European Union, they're actually going against the will of the people. But of course, the election, the referendum last year was very, very close. close, 52 to 48, on a turnout of about 70%. So less than 40% of the British electorate actually voted for leaving the European Union.
Well, now, the Scottish National Party wants Scotland, that part of Britain, to stay in the European Union. The leader of the Scottish National Party is Nicola Sturgeon, and she said this about Theresa May on the BBC.
Clearly, she sees the opportunity, given the total disarray in the ranks of the Labour Party, to crush all opposition to her, to get rid of people that disagree with her, and to give herself a free hand to take the country in the increasingly right-wing direction that she wants to take it in.
Back to Alan Cowell. Is that right, that this is a right-left argument?
I think it's an opportunistic argument in a way. Theresa May had said repeatedly that she would never call a snap election on this issue, that she would remain in office until 2020, when the next elections were initially due. So there are two aspects to this. One is that she faces the risk of a rebellion in her own ranks and wants to shore up the Conservative Party and her command of it through an election. I think that's a very important aspect to this. It might seem like inside baseball, but if we remember, a lot of what's happened in the UK over the last 2 years has been driven by disputes and factionalism within the Conservative Party, largely over the issue of Europe.
Now, the election is not like a presidential election in the United States. It's not a vote strictly on Theresa May. It's a vote on which party will have the most power in Parliament. What if she loses?
I think that's highly unlikely. If she lost, it would be an absolute disaster for her. It would not look great in Europe either. There's a lot of uncertainty in the broader picture. The French are about to embark on elections, Germany later this year. So if you've got now England, the UK as well, you've got the biggest, richest players in the European Union, all facing the uncertainties of a vote. Mrs. May is clearly calculating that a defeat is not on the cards. The question is really how big her majority will be, because the opposition, the Labour Party, is enfeebled and it's divided and it's led by an unpopular far-left figure, Jeremy Corbyn.
Alan Cowell, as always, great to have you with us. Again, a New York Times contributor talking to us from London. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Warren.
In a moment, why don't facts matter? On To the Point from PRI.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Well, we're only back with To the Point. Today we're taking another look at the emotional states of America, where facts don't just matter less than opinion, they are overwhelmed by opinion. Is it the consequence of our culture, our politics, or the way our brains are structured? We'll start with Tom Nichols. He's professor of the National Security Affairs at the Naval War College, and he's also author of The Death of Expertise, The Campaign Against Established Knowledge and Why It Matters. Tom Nichols, good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's first of all establish that you are an expert. You've got an MA from Columbia. You've got a PhD from Georgetown, certificate of the Harriman Institute for Advanced Study of the Soviet Union at Columbia. You're formerly on the Senate, a member of a personal staff of a senator for defense and security. You're a fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. So you qualify as an expert, as a person with established knowledge. Why do you call your book The Death of Expertise? Have people stopped listening to you?
Well, they've stopped listening to a lot of experts, and not just credentialed experts or people with doctorates or foreign policy experts. They don't want to listen to anybody. They don't want to listen to their doctor. They will argue with everybody from their lawyer down to their plumber or their electrician or their photographer. It's really a kind of narcissistic lashing out at anybody who a person suspects knows more than they do. And it's happening at all levels of society.
Why do you think that's happening now?
Well, I think there are several reasons for it. One is that I think for a good 30 or 40 years, Americans have been barreling toward a kind of new understanding of democracy that is almost a kind of radical egalitarianism, not just a system that gives us all political equality before the law, but somehow an idea that promises us all actual equality. That it's all summed up in the phrase, I'm as good as you. And this is something that's actually rooted in Western societies. The great British writer C.S. Lewis first warned about this well over 50, almost 60 years ago, that people were taking the idea of equality in a democratic society and running off the end of the earth with it to mean an actual equality among everyone. So I think that's part of it. But there are modern innovations, things like our modern university system, the segmenting of the media into stovepipes and echo chambers, and certainly the presence of the internet that have all served as enablers that have strengthened this basic tendency in people that's been growing for some time now.
So when we promise in the United States that everybody is equal, we don't really mean it?
We mean people are equal before the law, that a person who has, you know, an issue before the government or before a court or it wishes to express themselves in a publicly protected forum under the First Amendment, they all have equal rights. It doesn't mean that everybody's opinion is equally good or equally valid on all matters. And that's where we've kind of taken that idea that our equality to speak does not mean that we are all saying equally worthwhile things.
President Trump addressed the subject of experts and expertise a year ago on the campaign trail. Here's what he said.
You look at what China's doing in the South China Sea, and they say, oh, Trump doesn't have experts. Let me tell you, I do have experts, but I know what's happening. China's not, and look at the experts we've had, okay? Look at the experts. All these people have had experts. You know, I've always wanted to say this. I've never said this before. With all the talking we all do, all of these experts, oh, we need an expert. The experts are terrible.
Tom Nichols, back to you. Is that an example of what you refer to as narcissistic lashing out?
Absolutely. And probably a good time to point out that I don't represent the Naval War College here. I'm just representing my own view. But yes, the president used this very effectively. He spoke that language to an angry, thin-skinned, aggrieved population that really thinks that experts are just people trying to run their lives. And, you know, this all boils down to telling experts that they're, you know, this is like people en masse saying, you're not the boss of me. And the president captured that beautifully by saying, experts, they're terrible. Who needs them? All you need is your gut, your common sense. Well, you know, interestingly enough, now that the president has gone from campaigning to governing, he, in fact, has filled his administration with people like Jim Mattis and H.R. McMaster and Rex Tillerson and other people who have deep backgrounds and people who are of considerable achievement. But it was a great campaigning point to turn to, you know, an entire rally full of angry people and say, nobody is smarter than you. We can do this without talking to anybody who isn't in this room. All of us together here could run this government because really, how hard can it be? And that's just silly.
To the extent that the president now is relying on people you can call experts, he's getting some heat from his supporters.
Absolutely. They wanted him to kind of barrel in there with a few people, break the system, and to say, we don't need to talk to anybody who's smart. And I think the president did one other thing that's very interesting. He, like many other people, and you saw this in the Brexit campaign in Great Britain as well, he fused the idea of expert to the notion of elitist, which is a clever rhetorical trick, but not always true. Experts are not usually the most powerful people in the world. They usually advise people. But now that he's in power, it's simply not possible to execute the functions of a complicated superpower without relying on people who actually know how to do at least some rudimentary things at the level of national government. And like all presidents, he's found that out the hard way. And his supporters don't like it because he really coddled them and encouraged them to believe that running a government is something that any guy off the street could do. And clearly that's not true.
Just elaborate, if you will, on that distinction between expert and elitist.
Well, when people hear expert, they think of if you talk to people and interview them about this and they say, what do you think of as an expert? They'll mention everybody who isn't them, everybody that they perceive is in a better social situation than them. They'll talk about politicians. They'll talk about bankers. They'll talk about people who work in real estate. They'll talk about rich people, not realizing that experts are the people that are around them every day that make things work, that their plumber is an expert, their electrician is an expert, an airplane pilot is an expert, a diplomat is an expert. But these people are not necessarily members of the elite. And people, it works the other way as well. People who are members of the elite are by no means always experts. I mean, the president's relying increasingly on his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, who is, you know, a man who's not even 40, has a great deal of wealth, but has no expert knowledge in anything, but is clearly a member of the elite. So I think people fudge this difference in their minds because they assume that anyone who's an expert is powerful, and then assume that anybody who's powerful is also an expert. And this is just, it's simply not the case.
Tom Nichols at the Naval War College, not speaking for the college, but for himself, author of The Death of Expertise, The Campaign Against Established Knowledge and Why It Matters. Tali Sharat is Associate Professor of Cognitive Neuroscience at the University College in London. She is the author of The Optimism Bias, A Tour of the Irrationality, The Optimism Bias, A Tour of the Irrationally Positive Brain. Good to have you on our program. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
How does your book relate to what we're hearing about the death of expertise in this country?
Well, I think there's two points. One is that people really value control. One of the things that the brain's trying to do is try and control its environment so we can get as much good stuff and as least avoid all the bad stuff. And so control in and of itself is rewarding. We feel good about it. And if you give the expert the opportunity to make decisions for you, you feel like you're losing control. And I think that's one of the reasons that people really would rather make decisions themselves than even have the advice of the expert. And that's true in politics, it's true in medicine, it's true in many different domains. So I think that's one reason. The second reason is people want to believe what they want to believe. We want to believe that we are right. We want to believe that what we desire is what's true. And if someone comes with facts that are contrary to what we want to believe, we tend to try to dismiss it. We try to rationalize it away. We try to avoid it. And that's another reason why we dismiss what is not convenient for our true beliefs.
So one of the reasons then people aren't listening to experts, paying attention to experts, is that sometimes the experts tell them things that contradict their beliefs.
Yeah, that's true. An expert can tell us something that doesn't fit with what we already believe, and the expert can tell us something that we don't want to believe. And that does not generate a good feeling, and we try to avoid those situations.
How much research have you done into this in terms of neuroscience and the way that the brain actually functions?
Yeah, so we've done quite a lot on this. One interesting finding is we found that when you hear something that is good news, something that's even better than what you expected, the brain is really good at coding that information, and that it uses that information to change its beliefs. We see this in frontal regions in the brain. And when we hear information that is worse than what we expected, what we call bad news, the brain doesn't do as much a good job at processing that kind of information, and we use it less to change our beliefs. So anytime that someone comes in with something that we don't want to hear, our brain is less likely to process it than something that we do want to hear.
So are we ever going to be able to accept then the experts, or as to go back to Tom Nichols' book, The Death of Expertise, is it on the way out?
Well, I mean, I think one thing that's happening now is, of course, the availability of information. And I think that's a really important factor, because we feel we can go on the web and find the information ourselves. Of course, the problem is that we can find any information that we want on the web, right? Whatever question you have, whatever belief you have, whatever bizarre belief, you can find information to support it. And I think that's one of the reasons that we see this happening now rather than, you know, a few decades ago.
So you then agree that this is something that is more common now than it has been in the past. Tom Nichols, back to you. I'm just very interested in your take on what we've just heard from Professor Sharratt.
Yes, and I agree with her, because this notion of empowerment, I think, is really important in a political sense. People reject expertise now because it's almost like self-actualization. It's empowering. It feels good to say, you know, you're not going to tell me what to do, even if it's something that you know you should do. It gives you this great sense of control. You know, when we're talking about vaccines, for example, I mean, I'm a parent. Nobody likes seeing their kids stabbed with a needle. And you don't want to do that unless it's absolutely necessary. And I think, you know, parents find it very empowering to say, I've made a decision. I'm protecting my child. No faceless expert or doctor is going to tell me what to do. The problem is, as the professor just pointed out, you know, you're backing that up with information that you went looking for. Most people don't approach the internet or the media looking for new information. They go there to confirm what they already believe. And that's really the problem. It's that we are awash in a sea of good information. The problem is people immediately cherry pick their way through it to find the things they already believe. And then it makes them even harder to reason with after they've confirmed those those beliefs, because those little devices we carry in our pocket just reassure us all day long that we're right and nobody's going to tell us otherwise.
Tali Sharratt, you did examination of how people feel about and how they react and what they think. Interesting that I said feel, because that's what we're talking about here, is feeling rather than thinking about climate change.
Yes. So what we wanted to know is whether people can change or will change their beliefs about climate change with facts, or when we give them opinions of experts. What we found was that people took the facts that already conformed to what they believed to create even more extreme beliefs. So we first asked people, how do you feel about man-made climate change? Do you believe in it? Do you don't? How do you feel about the Paris Agreement? So based on those answers, we could divide people into people who really believe in climate change as man-made and those that don't. And then we gave them some opinions of scientific experts about what is the increase in temperature that they expect to happen by 2100. And then we asked them, please give us your own estimate after you heard these expert opinions. And what we found is that when people heard that the experts say, oh, things are really becoming worse, they would change their beliefs in that dire direction only if they already believed that climate change is happening and it's man-made. Those who didn't believe it didn't really take that information. And the other way around, if we gave them opinions of experts that are saying, actually, it's not as bad as previously thought, those who didn't believe in man-made climate change, they would change their beliefs in this very positive direction. And so at the end of the day, what happened is there was a polarization. People took the opinions that fit what they already believed and went even further away with it. And I think that's what's happening in the information age, right? There's information, as was said, to support any kind of belief that we want. And that's causing polarization rather than bringing us together.
All right. We're going to take a very brief break. And when we come back, we'll talk to a man who has challenged expertise in a very fundamental way, or if expertise is the right word, or I guess I should say he is using expertise in a very fundamental way to challenge the beliefs of a lot of people. It's a very, very interesting conversation that we're about to have. On our talking point later, nobody knew tax reform could be so complicated. We'll hear what that means in the context of the President of the United States. This is To the Point from PRI. Warren Olnebeck with To the Point, talking today about what Tom Nichols refers to as the death of expertise, the campaign against established knowledge. We're talking about what Tali Sharratt has discovered in terms of what she refers to as the irrationally positive brain, and why it is difficult for people to accept factual information that contradicts what they believe in advance. Dr. Willie Parker is with us. He is a reproductive justice advocate and an abortion provider in Alabama. His new memoir is called Life's Work, A Moral Argument for Choice. Dr. Parker, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You are an expert, too. Expert. You are a scientist. You are a doctor, and you understand the way the human body works. You have elected, despite your Christian conviction, to perform abortions because you feel that it is in the interests of science and also in the interests of justice. Will you explain both of those things?
Sure. And you give me an excellent opportunity right at the start. You said that I perform abortions despite my Christian convictions, but in actuality, it's because of it.
Thank you.
And the reason I make that distinction is because I did not have to, quote, take leave of my senses and take leave of the facts of reproduction and the biologic realities around that. But what I had to do was kind of figure out what Dr. King was trying to articulate when he said that science gives mankind knowledge, which is power, religion gives mankind wisdom, which is control. The two are not enemies. And as I listened to this conversation, it was very interesting. I hadn't thought about the fact that we're trending away from experts, but I think what people are pining for is a much simpler time when there wasn't as much factual information to account for, which is the result of scientific endeavor. The world is much more complex, and now we know not only we know how it rains, and sometimes we confuse how it rains with why it rains. And so I think that that inability to navigate between belief and science, especially, has become important when we talk about reproduction, because it has lend itself very well to the control of women's lives and bodies. And I just decided, as a Christian, there was nothing mutually exclusive about compassion and understanding and having a scientific understanding about reproduction, which allowed me to account for the fact that human reproduction is very inefficient. We have genetic abnormalities, we have miscarriages, we have unintentional pregnancies, and all of those happen in the context of a woman's life. And I decided that the compassion that my non-rational brain embraces through my Christian understanding is not in competition with the reality that women need reproductive health care in the form of abortion.
So let's start with the idea that life begins at conception. You're saying that it's a process. It doesn't just suddenly begin at a particular moment.
Right. You know, so I think in the way I try to navigate a reality-based world, as I understand that there are scientific understandings and non-scientific understandings. And I think the term life is one of those. And so because as a scientist understanding reproduction with gametogenesis or sperm and eggs and conception, if you say life begins at conception, I understand when somebody says that if they have a religious understanding of what life means, but I also will respond that that is a non-biologic understanding. Life began a long time ago when whatever we define as life showed up on the planet. So with a scientific understanding of reproduction, you have a live sperm and a live egg in order to have a live zygote or a live conception. You can't get a live conception with dead egg and dead sperm. So obviously life has to begin before conception. And so I don't say that to the antagonism or of people who choose a very non-scientific understanding. I just insist that we be clear about whether or not we're having a scientific, fact-based conversation or a religious and philosophic one.
You mentioned control of women's lives and bodies as being an important issue in this argument. And you have, in other places, compared that to the legacy of slavery. What's the connection?
Well, you know, the women and females, well, you know, and with regard to reproduction, it is by accident of biology that we end up either male or female, if we're going to call it that. But the fact that reproduction, human reproduction, plays out in the body of a woman, what we consider personhood or human agency, if we are all humans, all human beings should have right to bodily integrity and to control over their lives and their bodies. Because reproduction occurs in the bodies of women, if we assume that we have some other claim on that process, even as it occurs in a woman's body, and we seek to prioritize the outcome of reproduction over the woman in whose body that's being carried out, it is the same as saying that a woman becomes property, because the only way humans can reproduce is in the context of women choosing to accept reproduction in that process. If a woman cannot make a decision about whether or not that can happen, she is not free in the same way that a captured African who's forced to labor on behalf of someone else was not free. So it's the strongest analogy that I can think of as a man, given that I cannot reproduce with an organism growing in my body, to understand what it means to have to lose control over of your body and your integrity.
So you're performing abortions by choice in Alabama and in Mississippi, where a lot of people, I assume, disagree with you, and they say they disagree with you because of their Christian values. How is it that you're conducting, as you said at the outset, abortions because of your Christian values?
Well, I think it because values and beliefs are subjective, and because religion is a function of how one understands sacred texts. And another way for me to think about religion is we all have to make meaning and purpose of why we're here. Some of us choose not to do that. We don't need a meaning or purpose. And for those people, religion doesn't have a function or a role. But for those of us who it does, we're obligated to act on the basis of conscience. And I think we all have a sense of what is moral and what is right. And you don't have to have a religious understanding to arrive at that point. But given that my sense of what is moral and appropriate is derived from my religious understanding, that my religious understanding primarily considers us all humans as equal, then there's something inconsistent in my understanding where women and men don't have equal agency and they don't stand before whatever religious tradition you have in a way that will allow women to have the same power and control over their bodies that men do. And so I understand people who want to prioritize reproduction and interpret sacred texts in a way that makes that a priority. I simply believe that if women and men are equal, you cannot, and given that reproduction occurs in the body of a woman, you can't have more of an interest in a pregnancy that a woman is carrying than you do in a woman herself. Because if that woman doesn't survive, neither does the pregnancy. So I just my religious understanding leads me to consider women my equal and leads me to work to make sure that they have the same rights and control over their body that I have as a man.
Dr. Willie Parker, once again, a reproductive justice advocate, abortion provider in the South. His new memoir, Life's Work, A Moral Argument for Choice. Dr. Charlie Sherratt, Professor Sherratt, back to you at the University College in London. Your book is The Optimism Bias, A Tour of the Irrationally Positive Brain. Reflect, if you will, on what we just heard from Dr. Parker. And what sort of research have you done on this extraordinarily emotional issue of whether abortion should, in fact, be permitted?
I have not done any work on abortion or whether it should be permitted or not. I think, you know, it's another issue which people have different opinions on, same as climate change, same as gay rights. And what we find in the literature is that in all of these issues, people tend to, as we talked about, find the facts that support their opinions and interpret data in a way that supports their opinions. And that's true not only for these subjective matters. It's also true for things that are, you know, whether Obama is an American citizen, even something like that, which is not subjective. Even in those cases, you find that people interpret the data in front of them in a way that suits their own desires and beliefs.
When opinions are as strongly held as religious opinions are, does that make it even more difficult for people to accept the science? We just heard from Dr. Parker that you can't really say that life begins at one particular moment or another.
Yeah, so what determines whether anything will change your mind? There's four factors. One is what you already believe in. The second is how confident you are in what you believe in. The third is the evidence in front of you. And the fourth is your confidence in the validity of the evidence in front of you. And all of these factors will matter on whether you're going to budge or you're going to stay put where you are. And it's, you know, there's a good reason why we usually don't change our beliefs. It's not all irrational. The reason that when we hold a strong belief, evidence to the contrary is not going to change it much, because on average, that is the right approach. If you came and told me that you just saw a pink elephant flying in the sky, I'm not going to believe you, because I've had a lifelong experience knowing that elephants, pink elephants, don't fly in the sky, right? So there's a good reason that our mind works like this. It's not irrational. The problem is that because of this way that our brain works, it's really hard to change beliefs, even when the beliefs are false, even when there's data contrary to it. And it's interesting if you think about kids, you know, what children believe in. Children don't hold very strong beliefs often. They don't have the life experiences. So if you go to a young kid and you say, oh, there's pink elephants flying in the sky, they may believe you, right? They don't really hold those confidence beliefs like adults do. So it's important to remember that all of this happens for good reason. And at the same time, it can create problems and polarization and difficult in changing false beliefs.
Tom Nichols, back to you. Once again, author of The Death of Expertise. Do you agree with Dr. Parker that what we should do is base our policies on the science of medicine and what we know about the development of life in the womb and the issue of justice when women by accident are the ones that have to that have that responsibility, or if you will, or that biological requirement? Do you agree that biology, that policy ought to be based on the science rather than on opinions coming from religion?
Well, I reject the premise of the question, because science can't mediate values. And this is one place where people, I think, justifiably lose their patience with experts. Experts can tell you what is. They cannot tell you what ought to be. They can tell you about the medical science of pregnancy and reproduction. They cannot tell you when the quality of a human life starts to exist. I think Dr. Parker used the expression personhood. That's something that scientists, ethicists, religious leaders, community leaders, ordinary citizens, that's a value that has to be negotiated out through all of us in a democracy about what we're willing to accept, what we're willing to risk, what we're willing to tolerate. It's not just on abortion. It's things like the death penalty, on climate change. One of the points I make in the book, I always stay away from the issue of climate change because it has become almost like a religious argument between people who are both pro and con. If the people of Boston are told that 75 years from now, the city of Boston will slide into the harbor, if they choose to make that decision, the people have the right to be wrong. I mean, at some point, experts have to remember that they advise and propose. They do not rule and dispose. And I think that on issues like abortion, like climate change and other issues, the public does have its say. And I think the public often feels, and I think not without reason, even though I argue strenuously that the public should accept expert views in the way they live their lives, the public also, I think, fears that experts present their views in a way that will then lead to the experts' preferred policy outcomes. And I think that that's a legitimate concern that they have. And I'm guilty of it myself. I mean, I've written on things like nuclear weapons, where I put out arguments that I think I've tried to, you know, argue against nuclear weapons. And I think they feel very strongly that experts are trying to manipulate them with science. And I think we have to be careful about that.
Let me go back to Dr. Parker. You quoted Dr. King as saying that knowledge is power. Do people have the right to be wrong?
People absolutely have the right to be wrong in a free-thinking society. And in response, the examples that the previous speaker gave when he gave the note. He was absolutely right in talking about the difference between the experts being able to tell you what is and the question, the subjective question about what ought to be is one that has to be arbitrated. But one of the subtle things in all of his examples he gave with regard to abortion, how abortion is different from all of those, is all of the things that he talked about occur in a public space. The decision about whether or not to continue a pregnancy is a personal decision by a female and should not, it is not public space. So, but I think people absolutely, in a free-thinking society, you have to have the right to dissent and have to have the right to agree or not to agree. It reminds me, there's a saying that says, education makes people easy to leave but hard to drive. And so in a thinking society, people will agree and disagree. The process whereby, as the a previous speaker said, it has to be one that's done. That's what politics is. People arbitrating the differences that are influenced by their preferences and their interests.
This is a conversation that we could have for hours, but very quickly, if I may, we're almost out of time. Dr. Parker, where does this leave the question of expertise?
Yeah. I think in a world that's increasingly complex, down south we say, when you stay in your lane, there's no traffic. You know, I am not a brain surgeon. I'm a physician, but I'm not a brain surgeon. The reality is the expanding body of knowledge with regard to medical practice means that in order for us to manage the amount of information we have, expertise is not a question of something being optional. We have to respect expertise and use it appropriately.
Dr. Willie Power, once again, his book, Life's Work, A Moral Argument for Choice. Thanks so much for being with us. Tali Sharad, Associate Professor of Cognitive Neuroscience, University College London. Her book is The Optimism Bias, A Tour of the Irrationally Positive Brain. And Tom Nichols at the Naval War College, a professor there, The Death of Expertise, The Campaign Against Established Knowledge and Why It Matters. Thank you all so much for giving us a lot to think about. We much appreciate it. You can find all the segments in our series on kcrw.com/emotionalstatesofamerica. Back in a moment with our Tax Day talking point on To the Point from Public Radio International. Well, we're not only here with today's talking point. In February, when President Trump was negotiating a deal to replace Obamacare, he said nobody knew health care could be so complicated. The healthcare deal failed, and now it's on to tax reform. Speaking of complicated, it could get even worse. Here's NYU Professor Lily Batchelder, former chief tax counsel for the U.S. Senate Finance Committee, deputy director of President Obama's White House Economic Council. Great to have you on our program.
Thanks so much for having me, Warren.
So how complicated is tax reform?
Well, I don't want to belittle healthcare reform, but tax reform is at least as complicated, if not more so. With health, we're talking about reforms to 20% of the economy, and with tax reform, we're talking about reforms to 100% of the economy. So it's something that people have spent years working on. It takes months or years to draft a bill, to estimate the effects of it. So it is a very large lift and undertaking.
On tax day, we all think about tax reform in terms of the forms we filled out and sent to the IRS. You're suggesting it's involving a lot more than that.
Yes, it's involving how we tax businesses, how we tax cross-border transactions. It's involving people who have relatively complicated tax returns. For example, President Trump has more than 500 pass-through entities that he owns. So it can get very complicated, in part because Congress makes it that way, but in part because some people's economic affairs themselves are really complicated.
The president's own tax returns obviously have become an issue. Apparently, we're not going to see them. How important do you think it is that the people know where the president stands financially and what he might gain or lose as a result of policies that he might implement or not implement?
I think it's really important, and it's something that the Democrats have definitely increasingly been saying, that they're not comfortable really engaging in tax reform without understanding how he would personally benefit. But I also think there are a lot of sort of larger structural difficulties to doing tax reform that extend beyond the political moment of him not releasing his tax returns.
There are those who say that tax reform always has winners and losers. Somebody always loses when somebody else gains. Is it a zero-sum game?
It depends a bit on whether it's a revenue-neutral tax reform or not. So recently, a lot of people have been interested in doing revenue-neutral reform. Both Ryan and McConnell have suggested that they would do revenue-neutral tax reform. And that means that if it's truly revenue-neutral, which we could get into, there will necessarily be winners and losers. Another possibility is to do a bill that just cuts taxes for everyone, and then you can have all winners. President Trump's proposal during his campaign involved about $6 trillion of tax cuts over the first decade. Interestingly, there were still many losers, about over 8 million families and about 25 million individuals would have seen their taxes go up. But once you're talking about increasing deficits by $6 trillion, it's certainly possible to structure a bill in a way that there are no losers.
But revenue neutral means that the total isn't going to go up. So you're still working with the same total amount of money. Therefore, if someone gains, somebody else has to lose.
Exactly. And that is one possible way that we could see tax reform happening, particularly if Republicans want to do it without requiring any Democratic votes in the Senate. Then there are some procedural rules that require, at least after the first 10 years, that the bill be revenue neutral. And once you're talking about a bill that doesn't reduce revenues, if you're changing the tax code at all, you're going to be generating winners and losers.
You have a lot of experience in the Senate. Do you think, and not to mention in the National Economic Council, do you think that it's possible to have a bipartisan agreement on tax reform?
I think it's going to be tough. The most recent area where there was some overlap between the parties was on the possibility of revenue-neutral business tax reform. There was really disagreement. And at this point, I'm talking about under President Obama in a Republican House and Democratic Senate. There was disagreement on the individual side where the Democrats tended to think that we needed a more progressive tax code that raised more revenue. And Republicans thought we should have to generalize a less progressive tax code that raised less revenue. But there were some on both sides that were open to revenue-neutral business tax reform. Even then, there were barriers where they tended to define revenue neutral differently, and they also tended to have different views of how we should treat pass-through businesses. And so those were some of the big sticking points on a bipartisan effort. At this point, there does not seem to be as much interest on either side of the aisle in revenue neutral business tax reform.
Okay. You did talk, though, about a revenue-neutral plan being pushed by Speaker Ryan and Majority Leader McConnell. Who would be the winners and losers under their plans?
Well, so McConnell has not put forth a plan, but the House Republicans have. And although Speaker Ryan has said that he'd like to do revenue-neutral tax reform, his actual plan loses about $3 trillion over the first decade and even more beyond. So he has not yet proposed anything that is revenue neutral. He has just indicated that that might be his ultimate goal. But in order to get there, he'd have to radically revise his plan, which would generate a lot of losers. But we don't know who, because he hasn't revised it yet in a way that would be revenue neutral.
But you say that his plan reduces the total amount of revenue?
Yes, according to the Tax Policy Center, his plan would cost more than $3 trillion in the first decade and more than $2 trillion in the second, and that's ignoring the interest cost on that additional debt.
So who gains from that?
In general, his plan is heavily skewed toward the wealthy. So if you look at a family earning about $50,000 to $75,000, the average tax cut under his plan is $270, which is less than 1% of their after-tax income. And if you contrast that with a family earning over $1 million, they get a tax cut of about $330,000, or about a 15% increase in their after-tax income. So even if you're just looking as a share of income, millionaires are getting tax cuts that are about 30 times the size of those of a middle-class worker.
And if that's the case, and if there's a total reduction in revenue, there would have to be a reduction in services as well. Would there not? What services does he propose to cut?
Well, part of this goes back to health reform, where he had proposed block granting Medicaid and generally cutting a lot of services. We could, you know, go into all sorts of details. There's been discussions of Meals on Wheels and big programs like Medicaid. But in general, whenever you reduce tax revenue by that magnitude, even if you don't cut services in the near term, you're placing such pressure on the fiscal outlook in the long term that eventually you're going to have to make large cuts either to discretionary spending, which is at historic lows, or to mandatory programs like Social Security and Medicare.
Is the tax code so huge, thousands of pages, that you could say it's broken?
I think we majorly need to reform the tax code. I don't know if I'd go so far as to say all of it is broken. There's a lot there that we should not throw out. But there are certainly ways that we could simplify it, that we could make it more fair, that we could increase growth through tax reform. And that's why so many people over the years have tried to do it, not yet successfully since 1986.
All right. We said it would be complicated. You have helped us understand just some of the ways in which it would. And we could, of course, go on for a long time. Lily Batchelder, great to have you on our program. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks again.
Professor now at NYU, formerly tax counsel for the U.S. Senate Finance Committee and director of the White House National Economic Council during the Obama years. I'm Orman Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.